Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, and geared up now for episode number 789. We're working, marching on towards 800, getting there slowly but surely. And we have a great episode lined up for you today. I've been looking forward to this one. We have with us Dr. Benjamin Glad, who is a professor of New Testament down at RTS Jackson. Welcome, Ben. It's good to see you today. How are you doing?
Oh, it's so good to be here, Camden. I appreciate your time.
You look like you're in an interrogation room, to be honest.
Sometimes I'm at home, sometimes I'm in my office. This is a fitness. So I'm at a fitness place, which is in our neighborhood. Sometimes we go to the coffee shops. It's hard to do podcasts in a coffee shop sometimes, whether it's Starbucks or a local place. So today I didn't feel like going in. The problem, Ken, is you probably know this, is that when you go in to work at a school, it's amazing because everybody's there. It's fun. But the problem is you don't get any work done because you're talking to everybody. So I have to seclude myself in order to get work done. So
that's
what today is, seclusion.
Well, last time you were on, we had a bit of a nerd cast, geek cast. We talked about tips and tricks and software and all sorts of fun stuff about research methods and tools. Well, there's a guy, a podcast I listen to, a guy named Cal Newport. People might know him. He's written this book, A World Without Email, and a whole host of other books. Oh, The Deep Work is another famous one he wrote that was on the New York Times bestseller. But he's always talking about, he's kind of half joking, half serious about the different lengths that certain writers go to create a conducive environment for their own writing. So the most recent one he mentioned was a guy who would book intercontinental boat travel on these cargo ships, the ones that contain that have all the containers, like Captain Phillips, like the Maersk ships. He said he liked those because there are only 12 people on board. And so, then he'd work from like 10 p.m. to like 2 or 4 a.m. Everyone's asleep. I go, that's a little extreme.
I like the idea until the Somali pirates show up. That may hurt the writing a little bit.
Exactly.
You
wonder, maybe your environment's not the biggest impediment to your writing production.
But I mean, you could. I completely understand, but another perhaps easier way is maybe to just hop in your car, go to a hotel that's 30 minutes away.
That's Maya Angelou's method. Yep.
I mean, that just seems a lot less terrifying, extravagant.
I hear you. Or you can go to the local gym and rent out an interrogation cell.
Yeah, great. I love it. It's great. It really is. I do have to fight. And I tell my students this, and I tell people at church, because I'm always asked to, hey, can you speak here? Can you do this? Or can you read this? Or whether it's a dissertation or an essay or whatever, I really have to fight for my time, because if I start saying yes to everything, I don't have time to do anything. I'll just spend time on these other side things, which is fine. And I think God calls people to do that. It's just that me specifically, I really have to fight for seclusion and for tranquility. I don't know, whatever you call it.
Yeah. People kind of get that conceptually, but they don't always understand what that means specifically. But they'll also say, yeah, I understand, but what about my paper? Or what about my book?
You see, I'm the exception or whatever.
Or they don't realize the cumulative thing about it. And you just have to make decisions as a scholar if you're going to choose an intellectual life, or if that's your calling, which it is for you as a seminary professor. And to an extent, I'm involved in that a little bit, but you have to make choices. Otherwise your life gets eaten up. And it's, it's also not just a time equation, because your brain is not a muscle specifically, but there are some analogies to it being like a muscle and other things, but you have to manage your time and your energy as well. And I found, I have to have big blocks of time to do any intellectual work, especially writing. and has to be uninterrupted. But often I have to do that first thing in the day personally, because if I'm doing other things, then maybe even if I have 4 hours set aside in the evening to do some heavy research, researching and writing, I just won't have mental energy. So in that case, I might have the time, but if I didn't organize it correctly to work along with whatever I've got going on physiologically, or, you know, you have to learn yourself, and you have to protect that time. And you have also not only have to have the time, but you have to have it in the right place in terms of being able to take advantage of it.
That's right. You know, what typically happens, and especially at smaller schools, is that faculty gets asked to take on administrative roles, whether it's committees and deans and these kinds of things. And I resist. I try to just say, sorry, I can't. That's just not me. I mean, I think I could do those sorts of things, but I would have to just make a decision. Okay, am I called to do administrative tasks, or am I called to do other things? And so you really have to just make that decision ahead of time.
Yep.
I mean, there's a reason why guys like Don Carson and Greg Beale, they haven't done administration. They just made the decision a long time ago, saying, I'm just going to write and teach. And because if you write, teach, and administer or administrate, then you've got you're doing three things that are very taxing.
Yeah. And switching gears there's a cost in switching too, switching cost. I'll put some links to some stuff in the episode description in case anyone wants to follow up. Maybe you have some suggestions too, Ben, but one of them is this tiny little essay by a Silicon Valley investor named Paul Graham. He's actually quite famous. He runs this incubator called Y Combinator. So they do some interesting things to promote startups, but he has this essay called something akin to this, the maker schedule and the manager schedule. And he's talking about creative work and, you know, administration roughly, but this can be mapped onto intellectual work and administration in school too. So he has some interesting thoughts about the nature of the work and how to protect your time and how to engage in these things. Then there's another classic book by a guy named Sertillanges, Sertillanges. It's like a French name, I believe, on the intellectual life. And that's a book that a guy named Chris Castaldo loves as well. We've had conversations of, and it's a good book to read maybe every year, every 2 years, just to remind yourself of things. Cause I end up drifting away from, you know, the more intellectual rigor, it's hard. Last thing I'll say, sometimes you just have to do stuff you don't like doing. Like if you're serving on a session, you've got to write reports, right? Or you got to go to meetings, or you're forced. You have to go to faculty meetings, I presume. Mm-hmm. Like those aren't optional. Mm-hmm. So then push as much as you can to find out when your optimal writing time is, and make that sacrosanct, and then start saying things. This is what I do. Okay. Yeah. I've got to go to meetings. I don't do meetings until after 2 p.m. You know,
right,
I can't write then anyway. So, so I do the other stuff up front, and then, you know, fit the other stuff that you have to do that you prefer you didn't have to do, but you have to do, put that in your less prime time. Right. So there you go.
Right. You know, and there's something else that I also do. And maybe it's just me, but when, if I'm not writing or if I'm not producing, I think my brain just kind of will drift into those things. So whether if I'm driving or if I'm doing a hobby or if I'm doing landscaping or woodworking or whatever, my mind, I'm still thinking about what I've written, where can I go with the text, I'm still sort of munching on those ideas, so that when I do sit down the next day or maybe later that day, I pick up right where I was. I typically don't need to warm up. I know a lot of guys have to kind of warm up for a while and then they get into it. I, for whatever reason, not every time, but most of the time, I sit down and I start writing immediately because I have been thinking about these things the last couple of days or whatever. Even though I may not be physically typing, my mind is still sculpting and is still adjusting and thinking through ideas so that I'm able to just kind of pick up. And that by letting my mind and sort of cultivating that I think I've been a little bit more productive for at least me personally.
That's great. I love those tactics, those tricks. It's helpful. I think we discount the power of the subconscious sometimes. I'm not talking in a new agey way, but if you fill your mind with things like this is why you have ideas when you least expect, or why would you might wake up in the morning and have a solution to something that you've been thinking about for 2 weeks. Well, it's because your brain's still cranking on it. And that's also one of the benefits of having true leisure. And I've this is getting way in the weeds, but it's on point to a degree. It's really interesting. But I've even picked up this book by recommendation. I haven't opened it yet, but it's A Philosophy of Walking. And it sounds like bananas, right? But I was interested for historical reasons looking into this idea of the constitutional walk. And so many scholars, and just not even scholars, but just maybe public intellectuals or other productive people, you know, government officials and whatnot would often go on a walk, like maybe after lunch. And that is a productive time because this movement has some sort of physiological effect on our bodies, our brains. But having hobbies as well and true leisure, and I don't mean like a side hustle, you know, like if you're turning your woodworking into a second job, then it's not leisure anymore. But if you have true
That's right.
leisure, those kinds of activities, although demanding in their own right and beneficial and enjoyable, they often, I find things like that, you're working on a craft and you can get lost in it. It kind of distracts some of your whatever parts of your mind are more anxious or time bound, sensitive, all that kind of stuff. And it kind of frees your subconscious up to work on some of those more intellectual problems. So I don't know if this has been your experience, but I imagine maybe you're we're getting out the hand tools and doing some knurling or something, some really interesting, you know, making a bull nose on a windowsill or something. I don't know what you're up to. You're doing it with your hands, but boom, all of a sudden you've got some interesting biblical theological insight because in the back of your mind has been cranking on this stuff.
In other words, I tend to see very clearly because when I'm working at my laptop and I have all the books open, I've got so many things can get very cloudy and I can get hung up on details when I forget, okay, this is really what's going on. And I notice that when I do, when I exercise or that, or when I am working with my hands, my mind is able to sort of cut out all those details and just kind of say, no, this is where it's going. This is what I need to say. I think I figured this out. So I can kind of cut out all of the publishing fat.
It's good.
As it were,
That's so good.
when I'm working, I can just see very clearly in those moments. And I tend to do it if I do it after I've been working. If I do it before I've been writing, I'm not going to get really much out of it. But if I've been working for a couple of days on a project and then I have a hobby, then I can really sort of streamline it.
I love it. I get all my best ideas running or mowing the lawn.
Oh yeah,
Same ideas, same ideas. This is good stuff.
man. Yeah. Yeah, I typ mine typically involves bloody
Oh.
knuckles, like a busted wrench, sandpaper, mine comes at a physical cost.
I get in there with the woodworking a little bit myself. I enjoy it a great deal, but not as much. I don't I not as much as I would like. I'll have to pick up a project and then pick your brain on it sometime. I've got some big logs at my dad's, some big ash trees we had to
Oh,
take down.
nice.
So I would love to have a live edge desk. But anyway, this is
I'm about to build. See, because in the fire
Yeah.
we lost obviously everything up from our house, and so I'm slowly going back and I'm replacing it. So I need to build a I had built a walnut desk for myself in one of our spare rooms, and so I'm going to come back and I'm going to rebuild it. This time though, I'm going to do a live edge walnut. I like to go, it's called 8/4, which is 2 inches, and I found a local place that has some, and so I've been working on what do I want it to look like. So I'm super, that's going to be my spring project, is to build that nice live edge walnut office desk, and it's going to be so much fun. I'm really looking forward to it.
That's cool. That could be a family heirloom.
Oh yeah, and it's going to be super heavy, and I'm going to break. Yeah, something's going to break. I can assure you. Some,
Hopefully not your back. Today we're talking about...
Hopefully not my back, no.
Today we're talking about From the Manger to the Throne, Ben's latest. This is in the New Testament Theology series published by Crossway. It's been edited. The series is edited by Tom Schreiner and Brian Rosner. Really have been enjoying these books. I've got a handful of them on the shelf. Thank you to Crossway for sending these out. But worked through this book thoroughly. And delighted to talk about A Theology of Luke here. This is a really tremendous book. Ben, as we get started, we've been at it for a while, but now getting started on this topic. In the preface, speaking of writers, you mentioned William Faulkner, a good Mississippi guy. And you reference him. He's credited with saying that writing a book is like building a chicken coop in a high wind. And you say this book was very much like that. What did you mean by that? And what was Faulkner getting at?
Well, I mean, the idea is, where do you start? How do you finish? Where, how do you put the pieces together? There's adversity within the book and just external circumstances. And I bear this out as sort of at the end of that preface. Luke is a very difficult book. I mean, it's just difficult. And I think even Luke scholars who have spent a great deal of time, everybody says this is a pretty tough nut to crack. And then when you put it up against Acts, the second part of Luke's project, it's substantial. In fact, Luke, Acts together makes up about 25% of the New Testament. So that's considerable. There's a considerable amount of data and information, and the narrative is very tight at times. The language is difficult as well. So Luke on its own right is just difficult to synthesize. And so when Tom and Brian Rosner, so Tom Schreiner and Brian Rosner, when they reached out to me and said, hey, would you consider doing this? I had just finished my handbook on the Gospels with Baker. And because I had just finished that, Luke was still fresh. It's like, okay, I think I can put this together. And what's hard, Camden, is that this is a theology of Luke. This is not the theology of Luke. And what's so difficult about writing something like this is there are so many things to talk about. I mean, I could have written on 10 more topics, or it's difficult to figure out, well, which themes do I explore and how do I do that? It's difficult. And that's kind of what I meant. And then I use that Faulkner quotation for another reason. And I do mention this as well in the preface that our house had just burned and we were living in our rental house at the time. And I was managing all the construction in our house and making sure things were done right, which oftentimes they were not done right. Yeah. And it was COVID was going on. And I mean, I got two little kids. And when you have so much going on in life, it is difficult to focus. Everybody knows that. And so writing a book on Luke, which is difficult in its own right, plus all these other circumstances, my dad's funeral, and just, it's just hard. It's just a hard time to write. And that's really what I meant by executing that quotation.
How did the Lord, you write about this, I'm not bringing stuff up, you know, that isn't included, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how the Lord might have used this book in particular, well, Luke, Acts as well, but specifically Luke, to help you in that time. How was writing and thinking about these themes specifically beneficial to you in a tough spot?
Right. So every Christian doubts, every Christian struggles at moments. And typically the doubting is in moments of difficult times. But what I find so refreshing about Luke, and really every book of the Bible does this, but especially the Gospels and especially Luke says that he writes this book to Theophilus in verse 4. He says in verse 4, chapter 1, so that you, the audience in Theophilus, may know the certainty of the things that you have been taught. I'm a Christian. I know about Christ's life, death, and resurrection. But Luke has written a book for people like me and like you so that he can get into the nitty-gritty details of the gospel and tell us, no, this really did happen. And not only did it really happen, but Luke it's testifying to it. The apostles are testifying to it. And then the Old Testament itself testifies to it. And when you take it together, it creates a faith that is strong, a faith that is healthy. It is amazing how often I run into people who are doubting in their faith, and they just don't know the Gospels well. They don't know much about Christ's life. Well, it's like, of course you're doubting. Of course you have massive issues with Christianity, because you don't even know what Christianity is. You don't know what the Gospels are. So Luke has written this precious book for people like me and people like you who we struggle in the midst of adversity, but he writes it so that we would know the certainty. I love that. I love that word. And the Greek word, that's a good definition of that Greek word, the certainty. And it's just a tremendous, you know, not that we may know, but that we may know for sure that Christ is who he claims to be. What an amazing antidote for those who struggle in faith.
Yeah. Now this book is very accessible. It's scholarly, but it's also very accessible. I'd be happy to hand this book off to pretty much any adult in my church. But I'm curious if I might ask a couple little questions for those curious themselves regarding a special introduction. First, well, here's my two questions. You can take them as you see fit, but who most likely was Theophilus? And then what are current thoughts about, or at least what's the best ideas or the best guess? And then in the sense, you know, tell us about Luke Acts as a work, and what are the prevailing ideas about their form? You know, why are they separate books, but yet probably one work?
Right. I'll take the first one. First, right. You know, who is Theophilus? It's like asking me who wrote Hebrews.
Yeah.
Theophilus, we know exceptionally little. The only hints, we have two hints. The first hint is his name. His name means lover of God, Theophilus. And because of that name, and there may be some other clues, we think that he could be a Gentile.
Sure.
Who is very much interested, or before a Gentile who may have become a God-fearer, those who admired the Jewish faith and may even had converted to Judaism, but then became a Christian. So he may have two transitions. He may have gone from being a Gentile to a Gentile God-fearer, and then subsequently became a Christian. And there are little hints that may be the case. We don't have much to go on. The other piece, and this is a little bit stronger, is that expression, most excellent. That word there indicates that he has some type of position. Mm. Well, what position does that mean? It could refer to a government position. Position in society, those kinds of things.
It's not Bill and Ted's excellent.
It's
the most
not
excellent.
Bill and Ted's. You would think, but probably not here.
You're probably not.
And there's another. So, and now what's really tricky is his relationship to the audience of Luke Acts. And just because of the nature of this book, and Luke himself appears to be a Gentile, and Theophilus is probably a Gentile. And the emphases that are in Luke Acts, it appears as though that this book is written specifically for Christian Gentiles, but of course, secondarily, Jewish Christians as well. And so there's a very strong Gentile flavor to the book. The other piece, and this is sort of on the tenuous side of things, as my other observations are, Luke and Acts, these books are massive, as I've already mentioned. To publish them is exceptionally costly.
Yes.
In the first century. So we may have a benefactor mentioned here. That simply may be the case. That I know Luke is a doctor. Paul says as much. But he's not a 21st century doctor, and he can probably not afford to fund this endeavor.
He's got all those student loans.
He's got all those student loans, man. You got to pay back Caesar. And so here we have Theophilus, who is now a Christian. and he is in some type of government authority or something along those lines, and that he is likely funding this Luke Acts production. And that's why Luke will address him and he says, this is for you. There's a decent chance. We don't know for sure because it's not said, it's not stated. Sure. But that's likely what's going on here. And this was a very costly endeavor for Luke to write this project and then the project. The second question you asked was, what's the relationship between Luke and Acts and why are they two different books? I mean, very clearly, Acts is a strong break. At the beginning of Acts, we see Theophilus mentioned again. Luke talks about his gospel, and it's a nice break. We also have a change of genre or a literary type. So Luke is a gospel.
Yeah.
It's, we use the word biography. It's a Greco-Roman biography. It's about Christ, about his work. It's a gospel. Acts is not a gospel. It's not Greco-Roman biography. That's going to fit more in ancient history. So we have a shift of genre between Luke and Acts. In fact, if you just read Luke Acts straight through, you will notice a strong change there in Acts 1. So we have two types. So we have two books, but they're two different literary types, and that may explain. And then really, what's the content relationship? Well, that is Luke centers the gospel, centers upon the gospel, Christ's life, death, who Jesus is, where did he come from, his birth, his career, and then his death and resurrection, and then also his ascension. It's very clear here. And then in Acts, so we have the gospel in Luke, and then the gospel proclaimed in the book of Acts. The pouring out of the Spirit. Jesus ascends to the Father's right hand, and from there, he will pour out the Spirit upon God's people, empowering them to spread the gospel, to expand the kingdom, and proclaim his name throughout. So that's kind of what's going on in general.
That's good. How does Luke distinguish itself from the other gospels, even the synoptic gospels in the early chapters? What are some differences, some extra emphases that Luke might be putting out, and why might he be doing those things?
Yeah, that's a good question. So Luke tells the story of Jesus' birth through Mary. Matthew does so through the eyes of Joseph. Also in Luke, we have Mary's extended family mentioned with Zechariah and Elizabeth.
Right.
They're from Aaron. They descend from Aaron. And so it's a very priestly. We also have the birth of John the Baptist drawn out. And so we have these strong, there's a lot of continuity between John the Baptist and Jesus. And of course we get this in the other three gospels, but here we have the birth of John mentioned, and that's going to set up really a lot what's going to unfold in the book of Luke. For example, John the Baptist is very much connected to Elijah and the ministry of Elisha. Both of those ministries are very much tied to who John is. And then as the book of Luke unfolds, Jesus keeps coming back to these major figures of Elisha and Elijah. And so John the Baptist is going to kind of set up that paradigm that we're going to get throughout Luke. And so that's just one thing. And there are other, another thing is that in Luke 1:5, in the time of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah. And then of course we know Luke 1, in those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree. So Luke situates both the birth of John the Baptist and the birth of Jesus as being under the reigns of both Herod and Caesar Augustus. In other words, he's situating them in wider the history of the Roman Empire and the Jewish people, because that's going to then underscore Jesus as the true king. You know, Caesar, he thinks he's king of the world, but he is not king of the world.
Right.
And he is exalted. And now here is the birth of the true king in very low circumstances, and he will overturn really Herod's reign and Caesar Augustus' reign. Indirectly, that is.
I love the each chapter of this book, and you focus on different biblical theological themes and then develop them and interweave them or pull on the thread, you know, that we find in the gospel. And I love that so much. I love your approach. And it's most helpful for getting a sense of the book as a whole as you're developing here or explaining a theology of Luke. One of the things that becomes rather evident in the book is Jesus' own titles, not only what people call him, but even what he calls himself. What are the titles for Jesus that are most prominent in Luke specifically, and why might those be significant?
By far, his favorite title is the Son of Man. I mean, that's without a doubt. And that's really in all the Gospels, especially the Synoptics. Other people give him titles, like
some of them not so great.
Some of them not so great.
A glutton, like, and a drunkard. Called,
there's that one.
A madman.
A good one. You're right. There's that one. But a good one is when Mary says he will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High. And then we also have the Son of God there in verse 35, sure, of chapter 1. And so these, and he's obviously called David, these types of titles. It's more in terms of those things. What typically happens, and this is true of the Synoptics, is that the crowds and the disciples, they tend to mislabel Jesus. They tend to misidentify, or they only partially understand who he is. And so we can see that in the titles that they ascribe to him. But ironically, it's the demons who properly identify, right, Jesus. In fact, I don't know of one text, maybe there's one or two out there, where you have a demon misidentifying Jesus. I'm not quite sure that exists. It may be, but the vast majority of occurrences when you have demons speaking to Jesus, mm-hmm, they're going to give him a title that properly identifies him. Whereas we don't get that with Jesus' family or with the crowds or with the disciples. So there's, right, some massive irony throughout.
Yeah. And it even gets to an issue of faith, the nature of saving faith. You know, it also, right, has to include that trust and fiducia, because
that's
even
true.
The demons get, they not only know what Jesus claims and they not only agree with it and assent to the truth, but they don't trust in him. They rebel.
That's exactly right. And you know what? The problem, as James talks about, the problem is not their theology. I mean, I would argue that demons have a terrific Christology,
sure,
in some regards, probably even a better Christology than most. Mm. It's just that they refuse to submit. They refuse to trust. So they know it. They know the facts of it. They know the truth of it, but they don't know it personally.
Yeah, that's really terrifying, but also instructive.
It is terrifying, but it's very instructive.
One thing you mentioned here with another of the titles for Jesus is the Most High, or Son of the Most High. That's another theme that you identify throughout the book of Luke, that Luke often employs the language of high and highest, mm-hmm, more than any other gospel. And then you start to develop this biblical theological theme of reversal. How do those words, or that family of words, play into that theme, and why is that significant throughout the gospel?
Right, so we're going to pick this up in the Magnificat in verse 52 of chapter 1. He has brought down rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. And that's going to tap. That text is very much tied to Hannah,
yes,
to Hannah's prayer, remember, with the birth of, mm-hmm, Samuel. And like in 1 Samuel chapter 1, this is all really built on this nice typological relationship between Hannah and Mary and Samuel and then Jesus. And both Hannah and Mary are going to put their finger on the coming ruler is going to demote those in a position of power, and those who are lowly, he will then exalt them or lift them up. And that is huge. You can really read so much of Luke through that single verse, and that's precisely really what we get. If you read that verse, or if you read the temptation narrative through that verse, several things jump out. I was teaching on Luke 4 last night in my church. For example, notice the language, the exalted language in chapter 4, verse 5, and the devil led him up to a high place. Again, we get it right there. And then in verse 9, the devil led him to Jerusalem and had him stand up on the highest point of the temple. And then he says, the devil tells Jesus, since you are the Son of God, or if you're the Son of God, throw yourself where? Throw yourself down in order. Now, he was going to quote Psalm 91, that they, the angels, will what? Lift you up. That Jesus will be exalted, that this is a reference to the ascension. So this is a sneaky attack, because what Satan is offering Jesus is a way to be exalted apart from the cross, apart from the humiliation of bearing God's wrath. It's a way to get to the throne without the humiliation, essentially. And it's a shortcut. It's a way to get the glory without suffering. But that's not the biblical way. That's not the way that the Old Testament had anticipated. And that's not what God wants. And so he must go low in order to become high, in order to be exalted. And then that really is going to set the stage for chapter 10. Here in Luke 10, it's a very odd text, but it fits remarkably well with what we've been talking about here. When the 72 return, they've done this amazing job of exorcising all these demons. They say in verse 17, the 72 disciples returned with joy and said, Lord, even the demons submit to us in your name. They're shocked at how much success that they've had. And now we have verse 18. We can talk about 17 for a long time, but we won't. Verse 18, Jesus replied, I saw Satan fall. Notice the downward movement, like lightning from heaven. I have given you authority to trample on snakes and scorpions and to overcome all the power of the enemy. Nothing will harm you. Notice that downward movement. And that downward movement, Satan fall like lightning, that's a partial quotation or a strong allusion to Isaiah 14, there with the fall of the king of Babylon and his demotion. In fact, there in Isaiah 14, the king goes down to Sheol, down into the underworld. That's how low he goes. And so he's bringing that prophecy to bear. It's a borderline prophecy in here, verse 14. So there may be some typology involved. But what's fascinating is that 19, I have given you, the 72 disciples, authority to trample on snakes and scorpions. That's an allusion to Psalm 91, which is the exact text that Satan cited in the third temptation. So he's really fulfilling Psalm 91 the right way, and he's going to do it through his disciples. But there's something very interesting here at Camden, and that's, I have given you authority, the disciples' authority. So Jesus earned this authority to rule over the demons, to rule over Satan in the temptation. But here, because his disciples trust in him and follow him, they now inherit the right to dominion over the spiritual realm. So I kind of explore these features in
Oh,
that
it's
chapter.
tremendous.
It's an interesting chapter. Some people think it's a little speculative, but I think it's biblical.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm typological maximalist over here. But I think we
Right.
also see where the New Testament doesn't just give us the answers to the Old Testament, but also teaches us a method, the way we ought to be reading. And there's an apostolic
Right,
hermeneutic.
right. It's this, once you kind of get on the inside and how these authors are reading the Old Testament, you then start to feel the patterns and get into the rhythm, so you can then see their logic and why they make these connections. I think if you just stay on the outside, you're not going to see why they're making these connections. It's going to appear arbitrary, but it's
Exactly.
not arbitrary. Get inside it. If you get inside it, then you see the reason and the logic behind it.
I know we're running a little long here in terms of what we scheduled. I've still got a ton of questions. I'm not going to ask all of them, but I wanted to ask you if your captors are going to move you to another cell, or if you have enough, if you have enough time in your.
I can leave on my own free will.
Okay. Okay, good. Let me.
Of course, continue. They all say that. Of course, they all say that.
Well, I'm glad that the cuffs that are hooked to your table are the chains right. are long enough
yeah,
for you.
Don't
to...
look at that. Don't look at that car battery that's on the floor.
So, there's all sorts of things here, but I at least want to explore at least two more, and they're connected. And one is the theme of the Exodus, which is certainly throughout the entire Bible, throughout the New Testament, especially. But picking that up here in terms of Luke's usage of the Exodus, how does he approach it? Maybe uniquely, what is distinct of his treatment of the Exodus theme and the second Exodus in the Gospel?
Yeah, two things briefly. So Luke follows the structure of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And that structure is Jesus, his career begins there in Judea in the south. He's baptized there. The temptation is there. And then after John the Baptist is put in prison, Jesus, he moves his ministry or begins his ministry in Galilee. And then he's going to stay in Galilee until Passover. And then he's going to come south from Galilee to Jerusalem to celebrate Passover. In Matthew and Luke, Jesus traveling from Galilee to Jerusalem is not that long. I can't remember offhand. It's maybe like a chapter or something like that. It's not long. In Luke's gospel, Luke appropriates 10 whole chapters from the end of chapter 9 to the end of chapter 19. It's this large section on Jesus moving from Galilee to Jerusalem. And the way it's described and the way it's portrayed in Luke's gospel is that they are marching on, quote unquote, the way through this journey to they're moving from Egypt into the promised land there. But the difficulty here that it's the crowds are having a very difficult time understanding what Jesus is saying. And so are the Jewish leaders and to some extent, the disciples too. Like it is, this is where we get all of our favorite parables, like the parable of the prodigal son and these kinds of things. It's all found here in this long, slow, fairly depressing journey from Galilee to Jerusalem. But what Luke is doing, he's saying that here is Yahweh marching his people through this highway, and they are going to arrive in the promised land. But here's the thing, though. They get to Jerusalem. Jesus suffers and dies, and it's very difficult. Lots of confusion. So it's going to restart in chapter 24. And then now we're going to see the same journey, but we call that journey the road to Emmaus. And so here is Jesus traveling again with his disciples. Now it's just two disciples, but it's the same sort of thing that we saw on the long journey. Here, though, Jesus is going to supernaturally open the eyes of these two disciples so that they can understand his identity. They can understand what God is now doing through the person of Christ. Whereas the first journey, the first Exodus, as it were, in Luke, it's difficult. Whereas the second journey, it's enlightenment. They can now grasp who Jesus is and see how he's connected to the Old Testament. And that's, so it's really kind of a story. Then there's another piece here at the Transfiguration when we see Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus, and Luke says that they were talking about Jesus's exodus. And it's an interesting way. So Luke, in other words, is talking about Jesus' death in terms of an exodus. That is, he's really there on the cross. He's bearing God's wrath. He's in, quote unquote, spiritual Egypt. And then in his erection, in his ascension, and in his death and resurrection, he is then moving from death to life, this ultimate Exodus theme. And it's just all over the place. In fact, in Acts, the church is called the way, or the way of the Lord. That's right out of Isaiah 40. I mean, so it's this whole, it's so massive, Ken. It's hard to, it's hard to just say, well, it's here and there. I mean, cause it is everywhere throughout this. One thing that I, you know, one thing that nobody had ever talked to me about, or I've never read this, but it's so obvious that the Old Testament sets up a second Exodus. So you have a first Exodus and you have a second Exodus. And Jesus begins the second Exodus very clearly. All of the gospel writers are very emphatic about this, that Jesus is establishing the second Exodus, and that that second Exodus will continue into the new creation when finally God's, all of God's people are planted into the promised land. Notice that the Bible doesn't talk about three Exoduses.
Yeah.
There's not, okay, there's one Exodus, then there's a second Exodus, then there's a third Exodus. Like, it just keeps on going. Mm. So the point is that what Jesus is offering is a definitive redemption, a definitive move from Egypt into the promised land. That it's, he's not going to have to do it again and again and again. That it's a two Exodus paradigm. That once the second Exodus begins, there's no going back. It's not going to be recapitulated yet again. It's just, we're going to see a more fullness, a more full fulfillment of it when Jesus returns.
Yeah. I was talking to my oldest son. He's 11 now. I named him Derek, which it's an English name, but I named him from Psalm 1:6, the, you know, way, road, or path. Mm-hmm. And I told him that, you know, that theme is picked back up in the New Testament. You develop it a lot. Psalm 1:6 isn't necessarily talking about the Exodus there, but the same word in Greek is used throughout when Jesus says, I'm the way, the light, and the path. It's, but in Greek, it's hados. So I tell him, you should be thankful that I named you Derek and not Hados.
That's right. That's like when my dad and my mom, they were, I have two brothers, so it's three boys in our family, and they never got a girl, but they said that if they got a girl, they would have named her Stephanie Joy. And I'm like, hold on a second. You're telling me that her name would have been Stephanie Joy Glad? I'm like, you can't put Joy and Glad together. Who are you? It's like, that's why God's going to give you a girl.
Yeah, it would have ruined her life.
With her life. What are you doing? She would have gotten married when she was 13.
Yeah, exactly. She'd change it up. Got to mix this. Oh, that's right. Good. Yeah, I appreciate that. Maybe a couple things if you'd like to comment on, but you already touched on quite a few of these, which I love. So many connections with Isaiah. Isaiah is such a programmatic book throughout the entire Bible. But I wonder if you could pick that up. And you've already mentioned also about the wilderness temptation, but the wilderness theme that you find in the places of Luke and whatnot. The thing about this book is there are distinct chapters. And they all connect to one another, but not in a way where you're getting lost. Like, I'm not reading this book where I'm feeling like, man, this guy's got a bunch of ideas, but I don't know where this is going. So you executed on the book tremendously in the sense of giving a sense of the interconnectedness of it all, but yet sticking to the main themes of each chapter. But the ones that at least we haven't entered into directly might be the wilderness temptation or some of the themes in Isaiah. I wonder if you have any more thoughts on that.
Yeah, so the wilderness theme, you know, the wilderness is such a complex place and symbol because good things happen in the wilderness. It's not all bad. I mean, God calls his people in the wilderness. He nourishes them with his presence. He gives them the law. Like, there are just these tremendous blessings. In fact, even Isaiah talks about how the new creation will spring forth from the wilderness. On the other hand, the wilderness is a place of testing and trial and unbelief and grave difficulty. So the wilderness, it's hard. And I state this, that it's hard for now I'm applying that paradigm to Luke 4 when Jesus is tempted and tried. Luke 4 is so significant, that Jesus' temptation in the wilderness is so significant, that I think that all of the Old Testament flows through the temptation. In other words, let me just restate this. So reform, especially within the reform tradition, we would say that the entire Old Testament flows through Christ's life, death, and resurrection. That's a terrific thing. Mm-hmm. Amen to that. Mm-hmm. But what has gone underappreciated in that statement is the role of the temptation.
Yeah.
And if you just read the temptation is a very rich and complex event in Jesus' life where he is really taking the totality of Adam and Israel, and he's retracing the steps, and he's taking the story, the entire story of the Old Testament, and bearing, and it's on his shoulders, and he's redoing it, but with success. I edit some series, some biblical theology series, and I really, really want somebody to do a biblical theology of the conquest, because, you know, typically in discussions of conquest, it's very difficult with just ethical, obvious sure. ethical problems there.
It's intrusion, man.
They're unavoidable.
Get some Kleinian to do it.
It's, yeah, I know. However,
yeah.
And I'm writing a commentary on Mark, and I am seeing conquest themes all over the place. And Jesus is Joshua. And I tell my students that first day class, I'm like, I hate to tell you this, but Jesus' name is not Jesus. His name is Joshua. Mm-hmm. So right out of the gate, just with Jesus's name, it's a connection to Joshua in the conquest. And now the thing is that Jewish people wanted Jesus, the Messiah, to come in and vanquish the Romans. He doesn't do that, at least not directly. What does he do? He takes out the captain of the Romans, and that is Satan and his demons. And so it is holy warfare, and he is mm-hmm. conquering them, breaking apart their kingdom, and establishing this new age, establishing yeah. the age of righteousness in the spirit. And it's all built upon the conquest. And so I really think that the wilderness temptation is such a critical feature to seeing so much of the Old Testament yeah. work itself out in the life of Christ. And I think that is tremendously underappreciated. I really yeah. do. I mean, when I give lectures on that, I notice that people have just not, we typically just go right through the temptation and then we move on into Jesus' ministry. But that is such a critical feature.
Yeah, it is counterintuitive. We do discount the life and specifically the humiliation and suffering of Christ, and that being a critical element of the way that he accomplishes his work. You mentioned that earlier. That's tremendous. But it is counterintuitive. Right. There's so many things right. that are confusing, even the way that the kingdom comes. You think about Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew, for example. It seems opposite of everything that the people would expect from a king and a conqueror.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I was going to mention something I was just going over this with my students the other day, that the gospel, see, typically in reform circles, and we're not wrong to say this. When we say, what is the gospel? We'll say something to the effect of, it's Christ's substitutionary death and resurrection. Amen. That is terrific. But you know what? We got to add something. We need to say it's Christ's substitutionary life, death, and resurrection. He was born for us. He was tempted for us. He lived perfectly. He vanquished evil for us. He bore God's wrath for us, and he rose for us, and he ascended for us. The totality of Christ's life is for us. That is the gospel. The gospel is not simply just the end of Jesus' life. The gospel is the totality of it. And when you right. say that, it gives us so much more to work with.
Mm-hmm. Amen. And this touches on, you know, I'm a dogmatician, systematician, touches on the imputation of Christ's active obedience.
Yes.
Not just the passive.
That's exactly right.
Amen.
That's exactly, you know, if the gospels were only, if the gospel itself were only Christ's death and resurrection, well, guess what? We would only have record of his death and resurrection. Mm. But because the gospel is broader, which includes his life, we have the death and resurrection of Christ. It only takes up about a third of the material that we have in the Gospels. So the other two thirds, we've got to figure out why did they include it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Oh, Praise the Lord. We're about out of time. I mean, I got all day, but I don't want to keep Ben. You're too long, but I did want to give you time to talk about an upcoming event. I forgot to do that when we got started. We were having such a good conversation, but I'm real excited about this event. I wanted to come to it myself. I still want to come, but I've got a conflict of my own schedule that I haven't yet addressed. So maybe I can get out of my other engagement and come visit you, but tell us what you got going on in Plano, Texas. In about a month or
yeah,
two.
Yeah, so I'm playing it right. Yeah, hey, thanks so much. I appreciate it. So Greg Beal and I are doing a conference. It's just a one-day conference for specifically for preaching and teaching the New Testament use of the Old. You're not just simply learning it. We're going to show you how to teach and to preach it. There are going to be We've got four plenaries, I believe. We're going from breakfast all the way through dinner. We've got plenaries. I'm going to do one of the plenaries. We're also going to have breakout sessions. That is, this is how you preach the use of the Old Testament. I'm going to do the one on the Gospels. Greg's going to do one on Paul. And we're going to work through. Think of it in terms of this is a classroom.
Yeah.
This is for pastors to learn. Most conferences that are offered are for pastors to get excited for fellowship, that kind of things. Hey, this will be part of that, of course, but really our main purpose in doing this is to help preachers and teachers, men and women, be excited about the New Testament use of the Old and teach it well. And Greg and I are thrilled to be doing this. The date is Friday, April 28th. It's not going to be expensive. I don't know how much. I'm waiting on that. I'll find out in the next day or two. It's not going to be much. We would love to. Our goal is to have like around 100 people there. I think we can get That's it. Great. I have dozens of people who have contacted me and asked me to send them more information when I get it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be at it's going to be a couple of churches. I know that the main church is Town North PCA, but I believe there will be a coalition there. And the conference center is going to be amazing. It's going to be a very nice venue. And Greg and I are thrilled to do it.
That's great. So, we'll have available as soon as we're expecting the info to come in before this episode's published. We don't have all the details right now or a registration link, but as soon as we have them, I'll include them in the episode description for this episode. If you have any questions in the meantime, you can email mail@reformedforum.org and we'll pass them along, or by then we'll have info to send to you as well. But again, this is for people who may be listening, who knows when, April 28th, 2023 in Plano, Texas. So very exciting conference on the New Testament.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Yeah, I mean, I go to the conferences all the time, and most of them are on the let's get excited, which is great. I think that's a terrific thing. This is going to be more on the learning side of things. We're going to give you it's basically a class, and I think everybody will be just thrilled to hear it.
Absolutely. Well, we've been talking today about a lot of things, but check out this book, From the Manger to the Throne, A Theology of Luke. It's in the New Testament Theology series by Crossway, edited by Tom Schreiner and Brian Rosner. And this book, written by our guest today, Benjamin Glad. Thanks so much for taking the time, Ben. It's always really fun to talk to you.
Oh, thanks so much.
Yeah.
We'll have you back. We could talk for hours. That's the problem.
Yeah, we gotta pace it out. But we'll get back to it soon enough with your next project. Head on over to reformedforum.org, everyone, for information about what we have going on, upcoming courses, new video courses that are being published, new books, all sorts of interesting things, all available online. But I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.